This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. In 1961, during the Civil Rights Movement, the Congress of Racial Equality recruited volunteers for a series of bus rides that were known as Freedom Rides. David Fankhauser, who was a 19-year-old student at the time, boarded a bus to Jackson, Mississippi. There, he and the other volunteers faced violence and imprisonment for protesting racial segregation at interstate bus terminals. Fankhauser shared his experiences during a recent talk at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center, and he joins us this afternoon. David, thank you so much for being here.
It's an honor and a pleasure.
Really good to see you. How did you get involved with the Freedom Riders in the first place? You're a teenager, and you're in college.
Well, I was in college. My family was low income, so we couldn't afford college, but I heard that Central State College, which was a 99% black state school in Ohio, was trying to integrate. And so I was a beneficiary of reverse affirmative action.
Okay.
And so they gave me a loan and a work study and a scholarship. And so I was able to go to school at Central State. Now, that being a black school, we were also involved in civil rights actions in Xenia, Ohio, it's in Wilberforce, Ohio. And when the Freedom Rides had been the buses had been burned, and there had been beatings in Birmingham and Montgomery. And Congress of Racial Equality said, "That's enough. Somebody's going to get killed. We're going to pull the plug on the Freedom Rides." But Diane Nash, one of the co-founders of Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Nashville, said, "We can't stop now. We've got to keep the rides going because we have the attention of the world." And so she called around to black schools in eastern half of the United States. One of the schools was Central State. And so I got the call, and the next morning I flew to Montgomery and was whisked to Ralph Abernathy's house, where I hid out until we had enough riders to get a busload.
And that was civil rights leader Ralph Abernathy. You also met Martin Luther King Jr., did you not?
I did indeed. In fact, when we arrived at the Montgomery airport around 8 o'clock, we were picked up by a black man in a station wagon. And the first thing he said is, "Lay down on the floor in the back. Don't let anybody see you." And he went straight to Abernathy's house. As we walked into Abernathy's house, who is in his pajamas is sitting on the couch and that was Martin Luther King. So he was there at the time and was central to the planning and carrying out of the Freedom Rides.
And they didn't want you being seen because the Klan had actually attacked Abernathy's house.
They had blown
times.
It up. Yeah. They had blown his house up, and they were afraid, and they said, "Don't go anywhere near the windows." The Klan was very, very active, and they had already perpetrated violence in Anniston, Birmingham, Montgomery, so that they were very active and were very angry about our actions.
Now, this was in 1961, but there'd actually been some Freedom Rides before that, weren't there, like in the late 1940s, I think?
That's right.
Okay.
So the background is that a woman that I don't think has gotten sufficient attention, Irene Morgan, mm-hmm. Was on an interstate bus and refused she refused to sit in the white waiting room, and she was arrested. She took it to court, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and what is called the Morgan decision said it's illegal to segregate interstate travel facilities. And that was in 1946. In 1947, there was the first Freedom Ride, which lasted about two bus stations before they were arrested and beaten, and they called that one off. So the very first one was in the 40s, and then here it is, 1961, and the South is still enforcing segregation.
So they're ignoring these Supreme Court decisions.
Exactly. And our whole goal was, A, to call attention to the fact that the law was not being enforced, and B, to try to get Bobby Kennedy, Attorney General, to issue an injunction ordering the South to enforce the law.
How did you get involved in civil rights? What was your family's influence on all that?
Well, that goes way back. My mother was an activist, and when I was 10 years old, we were part of a caravan that was going to go to Coney Island. Now, we were We were not well-to-do, and we could never afford to go to Coney Island. But oh, we're going to Coney Island. Great. Well, the caravan was, in fact, an integrated caravan, including Marion Spencer. And when we got to the front gate of Coney Island, they refused to let Marion Spencer's car go through, and we were in the car just behind her. So we sat there for 2 hours until they shut down Coney Island. So that was in the early 50s. So that was one of the earliest actions that I was part of as a 10-year-old child.
But at that time, you didn't think you were going to be part of an
no,
action?
No, honestly, I was not. It was not part of a personal commitment. I thought we were going to Coney Island. Although I understood. I mean, I had seen the effects of racial hatred as a child growing up in Muncie, Indiana, and also in Cincinnati.
Yeah, it's interesting that it happened in Cincinnati, that we had that level of segregation going on.
Cincinnati was a southern city. The five and dime stores had segregated lunch counters. Swimming pools were not integrated. In fact, I was speaking with a gentleman at the Freedom Center who said he went to Withrow and blacks were not allowed to swim in the swimming pool at Withrow. And if the black went in, they would drain the pool. I mean, it's scandalous to think that's
hard to believe, isn't it?
Here in Cincinnati.
Yeah. Very hard to believe. Now, you were talking about Martin Luther King Jr. earlier. Did he actually participate in these freedom rides?
No. He was integral to the planning, but he was on a suspended sentence at that time. And if he had been arrested, he would have been jailed for 2 years automatically. So it would not have been appropriate for him to get arrested. Also, he was an important fundraiser that helped. I mean, we didn't have money. I did not have money to fly down to Montgomery on the spur of the moment. So the funds for that, for bringing Freedom Riders in, came from that kind of fundraising activity.
How many white people helped out with the Freedom Rides? Were there quite a few involved in that?
On the bus that I rode on, there were two of us that were white out of seven. I would guess that out of the entire roughly 400, there were 400 people arrested in Jackson between May and September. And I would guess fully one-fourth of those were white. But it was for me and for many of the whites, this was not – we weren't just fighting for justice for blacks. We were fighting for an America that we could be proud of and that was living up to its ideals.
Yeah, and if I understand correctly, too, these freedom rides actually inspired some similar freedom rides in other countries. I think Australia had one in the early – it was 1965.
Teach me about it. I'm not aware of that.
I was hoping you could. They did this on behalf of the Aborigine people.
Mm-hmm.
They actually had a freedom ride in 1965 in Australia. That's the extent of my knowledge on it. Yeah. But I just think it's interesting that they say they were inspired by what they saw in these early 1960s freedom rides in the United States.
The civil rights movement up until the freedom rides was a highly localized effort. The Montgomery bus boycott, which Rosa Parks sparked and which Martin Luther King and Ralph Abernathy planned, and that was the occasion that Ralph Abernathy's house was bombed, was a localized event. The lunch counter sit-ins were always localized. It was not a national movement. The Freedom Rides, however, once Diane Nash started putting out the call.
And she was the one who was insistent that we keep doing these.
I'm telling you what. Said. She is my heroine. Without her, we would not have had the Freedom Rides. And I think she has not gotten the recognition that she deserves. By the way, women did a lot of the hard work in the civil rights movement, and I'm not sure they always have gotten the credit that they deserve for that. And again, you think of Irene Morgan, you think of Rosa Parks, you think of Diane Nash. These women were very important, central to the effectiveness of the civil rights movement.
And you said Diane Nash puts out the call, and where does it go from there?
Well, okay, so she called from – she was a member of SNCC. She was one of the co-founders of SNCC. And she placed the call out, and people initially were always all from black universities in the eastern half of the United States. But then The day I got there, which was May 24th, got to Ralph Abernathy's house, there were 12 Yale Divinity students that were going to take the bus to Jackson. Now, that was the first bus after the firebombing and the beatings in Montgomery and in Birmingham. And it wasn't clear what was going to happen. But the South wised up that those beatings and the burning of buses was not good press.
Right.
So.
And it was only getting people, it was only calling people to action.
Absolutely. And it was worldwide. It was headline news around the world. So the South, it was wise to an extent, said, okay, we're not going to have any more violence, calling out the National Guard. And when I got on the bus in Montgomery, the bus station was surrounded with the National Guard with fixed bayonets. And so when these Yale Divinity students arrived in Jackson, National Guard was out. There was no violence, but they were immediately arrested. And it was clear that the new Southern strategy was to arrest them immediately. Well, they bailed out right away. That night in Abernathy's house, in what is a very memorable occasion for me, we sat around Abernathy's kitchen table with Martin Luther King, Fred Shuttlesworth, Rab Abernathy, and I was sitting there like a little 19-year-old. I'm not saying that I participated, but I was there, and it was there that we decided the new strategy for the Freedom Rides would be jail, no bail. In other words, we're going to fill the jails up. And at that point, the call then started going out around the nation for dedicated people to come to Montgomery to ride the bus to Jackson. And so the intent was then to fill up the jails in Jackson. And subsequently, when we filled them up, then we went to Parchman State Penitentiary.
Tell us about the Parchman. That's a rather harsh place. It's not just your typical...
It is infamous. And anybody that's familiar with the blues is familiar with Parchman Farm. And it is a 1,000-plus acre farm that is farmed by inmates. And it's in the heart of the Mississippi Delta. And it is notorious for its violence. And I was actually glad when I heard that they were going to ship us to Parchman, because up to that point, we'd been sitting in a Jackson City jail doing nothing. Well, not doing nothing. We were on a hunger strike to try to get Bobby Kennedy's attention. So I thought, well, we're going to go to Parchman Farm. I'm going to get outside. I'm going to be able to chop some cotton.
Well, which is better than sitting in a cell.
For me, it is. So, yeah. But it turns out that instead, they confined us to the maximum security unit in the heart of the penitentiary on death row, right next to the gas chamber. And 8 by 10 foot cells, 2 men to a cell. And we got no exercise. We got no mail. We got a shower a week. And so there we were in the heart of the maximum security unit.
You said you arrived at that one point and there were National Guard troops all around. They had fixed bayonets.
Yes.
What, as a 19-year-old, what were you thinking at that point?
I was very conflicted. I'm raised, I have a Quaker background, and I'm a believer of nonviolence as a way of life. And I am not a supporter necessarily of the armed forces. But I have to confess, I was not entirely sad to see these guys with fixed bayonets holding back an angry white crowd.
Yeah.
But it was a shock to my system to see that. But it was clear that there had been some vicious beatings in Birmingham and Anniston and Montgomery, including many of the Freedom Riders had been hospitalized, which is why Corps called off the Freedom Rides. So it was quite remarkable, but I was, by the same token, I was glad because it was clear they were going to prevent violence and prevent death, including my own.
Well, it probably dawned on you that this was a serious situation, that there was danger involved in this.
It was. And as a 19-year-old, what do we know about death? I mean, we send our 19-year-old boys are the ones we send off to war. And I think that I did not have a full appreciation for the danger that I was getting into. But I quickly became aware of it, and I was in a state of terror the entire time that I was in Alabama and Mississippi.
But it took courage to do this.
Well, somebody said, "You're not brave if you're not afraid. You have to be afraid, and then if you do it anyway, that's what bravery is." So I don't know that I was brave. I think it's more like 19-year-old idealism will make you do things that you feel is right. And
but looking back on it, you're glad you did this.
I was just mentioning to Selena before, the woman that
our assistant producer, yeah.
Assistant producer, that I consider it really one of the high water marks of my life, the time that I spent in Parchment State Penitentiary. It's a badge of honor. And I was in jail with some amazing people, including John Lewis and Stokely Carmichael and Jim Farmer. These are all major leaders in the civil rights. And John Lewis is the bravest person that I know of. He was beaten up twice. He had his head opened up with a tire iron, and he got back on the bus and he was arrested in Jackson and sent to Parchment along with me. So, and now he's such a treasure of the United States, and I think he's the conscience of the United States government, in my opinion.
So, David, how did this work? You had these segregated waiting rooms at the bus stops. Mm-hmm. So you'd have a white section, you'd have a black section.
No, white and colored.
Okay.
Sorry. No, I just,
that's,
you know,
the correct terminology
of
the time.
I know, and that's what it was. That was, yeah.
Yeah, that's the terminology that they were using.
So what we did, now, initially I thought that the whites would go in the black waiting room and the blacks would go in the white. No, we all went into the white waiting room and sat down together. So there was, I think in part, the idea is the whites are not breaking any law to sit down there. But they, when we sat down, Captain Ray, who was the police chief in Jackson, came up and said, "Y'all have to move on." And I said, "Why? Why should I do? Y'all have to move on."
I'm not breaking any law.
I know. And so the third time he said, "Y'all under arrest." And so we all were led out into the paddy wagon and taken to the police station and booked.
And that's how you eventually end up at Parchment.
So after 10 days, there were enough Freedom Riders that had been arrested in Jackson to fill up the city jail and the county jail. And so we were put on what looked like a school bus, except it was gray with bars on the windows. And we were it's about a four-hour drive from Jackson up into the Mississippi Delta to Parchment. And
you're talking about you're trying to get a response from Attorney General Bobby Kennedy
right.
at the time. What did he eventually say? Yeah, we need to do something with this.
He had to. Honestly, that was one of the successes of the Freedom Rides. The Kennedys really did not want to touch the subject. I mean, they may in their heart have known that segregation was un-American, but they recognized that the leadership of the Democratic Party was primarily from the South, the so-called Dixiecrats. And they knew that if they enforce the integration laws, that the Dixiecrats would jump ship and would go to the Republican Party, which is exactly what they did. As soon as the civil rights law was passed, en masse, the Dixiecrats all became, and to this day, the most conservative wing of the Republican Party consists of these Southern Republicans, former Dixiecrats, so, including Jeff Sessions, by the way, if I may use his name.
If you may interject there. What are the lessons from the Freedom Riders that apply to today?
Well, I was in communication. I've been in communication with Diane Nash, and she said something I think is very interesting. She said, when they write history books, they write about presidents, they write about generals, they write about wars, but the history books really need to talk about citizen-made history. And what I like to say to all the people in America, that it's up to them to make a history that they're proud of, and that the citizen-made history is the one that really is important, because that comes from the grassroots, and it's there that the change in heart comes about.
David, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's been a pleasure.
I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you very much.
David Fankhauser, who was one of the Freedom Riders in 1961. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Rick Andrus was the technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now coming up next on 91.7 WVXU.